Tune in to KBOO on July 4th through the 7th for a live broadcast from the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. We'll start the broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival on Thursday, July 4th at noon, and broadcast the fest every day from noon through 10 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, the largest celebration of blues, soul, funk, and rhythm and blues west of the Mississippi, July 4th through the 7th from noon to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices of a People's History, a movement of movements, on Wednesday, July 10th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Voices of a People's History celebrates diverse movement leaders by sharing their stories. Members of our community perform readings of notable speeches and essays from inspiring figures past and present, a radically empowering opportunity to hear the echoes of history in the present day. Again, that's Voices of a People's History, a movement of movements, on Wednesday, July 10th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland State University, offering a master's degree in urban and regional planning for those who want to shape cities and inclusive, vibrant, livable communities. More information online at www.planning@portlandstate.org. Next up, we have the bike show.
Takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain.
Show broadcasting from the KBOO studio in Portland, Oregon. My name is Alon Raab and our engineer today is Ty Walker. Good morning, Ty. Also, a warm welcome to our listeners, Jim, Jenny, Rachel, and Gino Nugget Bartali. Today, we are happy to have as our guests Michael Cranish and Evan Friss. Michael Cranish is a Washington Post journalist and author whose latest book is The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor, America's First Black Sports Hero. Historian Evan Friss will join us in the second half of the show to discuss his new book, On Bicycles, A 200-Year History of Cycling in New York City. Before we speak with our first guest, a few news items from the bicycle universe gathered by April Streeter and Alon Raab. Pool noodles, those colorful pieces of foam, are no friends to the environment, but they are showing up on bicycles, attached to the back fender or back rack as a gentle way to help cars keep their distance. San Francisco Gate's Michelle Robinson attached one to her bike so that the 63-inch long bright yellow bike dongle jutted just about 3 feet outward, the exact distance to keep drivers compliant with California's legally specified safe passing distance. Robinson felt that cars paid attention, but the noodle prevented her from passing other cyclists in bike lanes. After a week of riding with the gadget, she decided that it slowed her down and made her stick out too much, but she envisions continuing to use it for longer road trips. After working with over 100 cargo bike enthusiasts, filmmaker Liz Channing released her documentary called Motherload. The full-length film recounts her quest to keep biking after her twins were born and the universe of cargo bikes and riders that she discovered. A crowdsourced documentary, Motherload is an uplifting tale about reconnecting with people and places, dispelling some of the isolation that our car-based and fast-paced culture creates. In the coming month, The film is being shown along the West Coast. The Portland premiere takes place at 7 p.m. on Sunday, July 7th at the Clinton Street Theater, and a meetup group is meeting at Colonel Summers Park at 5:45. You could find out more about the film at motherloadmovie.com, and next month our show will interview the director. And finally, the British Guardian newspaper reports that a London cyclist who knocked over a pedestrian who was looking at her mobile phone while crossing a road when he had the green light to ride has been ordered to pay about £100,000 or $125,000 in compensation and costs in a case that could set an alarming precedent. Both the cyclist Robert Hazeldon, a garden designer, and the pedestrian Gemma Brushett, who works in finance and also runs a yoga retreat, were left unconscious after the collision, which took place near London Bridge. The pedestrian was awarded $5,000 in damages, but the cyclist was also ordered to pay the large legal costs. The judge, Shanti Munger, said that both were equally to blame, but only Brushett was entitled to a payment because she alone had put in a claim. Cyclists must be prepared at all times for people to behave in unexpected ways, said the judge. And that's a few news items from the cycling universe. Our first guest today is Washington Post journalist and author Michael Cranish. A political reporter, Mr. Cranish has written several books about American leaders, Thomas Jefferson, John Kerry, Mitt Romney, and Donald Trump. His new book is The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor, America's First Black Sports Hero, published by Scribner. Good morning, Michael, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And I assume this catches you in Washington or New York?
That's correct. Okay. In Washington, yes.
How are things in Washington this morning?
They're a little bit hot, probably hotter than where you are.
Are you talking about the weather or politics?
You can take it as you like, but you know, okay. The weather I'm talking about.
Well, thank you for being on the show. Before we get to Major Taylor, I'd like to ask you a personal question. In the book's acknowledgement section, you mentioned your dad. And write about how he encouraged your love of history and writing, and also gave you your first bicycle. Tell us, please, a little bit about that first bicycle and maybe some of your memories.
All right. Not expecting that question, but I'll give you the answer. my mom and my dad both gave me that bike. My recollection is I was 7 years old, and it was the holiday season. And everyone else in the family, I have three siblings, had been given their presents, and there were no presents for poor me. And my parents asked me, would I please take the wrapping paper down to the basement and put it in the trash? So there I went at 7 years old, down the steps to the basement, and there awaiting me was a bright red Schwinn bike, which they knew was what I wanted. So that was their way of surprising me, to put it mildly. Something I still remember all these years later. And it sparked a great love of cycling. My family, all of them are cyclists. So something we all did as kids. Both my parents had their own small business. So they didn't have time to cart us around in a minivan. There was no such thing as a minivan at the time, but they didn't have time to do that kind of thing. If you wanted to go someplace, you took a bus or you took a bike. And I preferred the bike. So that sort of started me off on the bike many, many, many years ago.
And your political reporter, author, how did this book about a cyclist come about?
Well, 18 years ago, I was a reporter at the Boston Globe, and Major Taylor had lived much of his life in Massachusetts. So at some point, I heard about his story, how he was African-American in the 1890s and went against the great white riders of the day and became a national world champion. And as a cyclist, I was curious, just as a human being, I was curious how he did this, very interested in history. And I learned that his daughter, who was then 96 years old, was still alive and living in Pittsburgh. So I got very interested in the story. I arranged to see her in Pittsburgh, and that helped me write the story. I wrote a magazine story for the Boston Globe about Major Taylor. Why is this person unknown, basically, is what I wrote about. I went to look at his archives, which are kept in a museum in Indiana, and having done that story in 2001, it came out the weekend after 9/11. And I got a lot of response to that story. It occurred to me, this is really before email and so forth. I had so many letters and things that I thought, there's so much interest here. Maybe this will be a book. At that time, I'd never written a book. So I thought about it, but, you know, pretty quickly I had other things going on. But I did start tucking away information about him. I thought maybe there's a larger story about American history to write here, about the Jim Crow era, the Gilded Age, when cycling was, you know, the craze of the country, when cycling really dominated for a brief window of time in our country's history. So I just kept collecting things over many, many years. So it's something I pecked away at, not something I sat down to do a couple of years ago, but I worked on off and on over the years.
Yeah. And so tell us a little bit about Marshall Major Taylor, his background, his family, sure. And early years.
Well, Major Taylor was born in Indianapolis, Indiana. His father and mother had lived in Kentucky. His father was a soldier for the North in the Civil War. He was actually at the fall of Richmond. So his father had, you know, seen much and knew much about the fight for freedom from slavery. The family moved to Indianapolis, and that's where Major Taylor was born. For a while, Major Taylor had a pretty prosperous upbringing. He was from a poor family, but he was sort of taken in, adopted, if you will, not really adopted, but taken in by a white, wealthy family that had a son that needed a playmate, and Major Taylor became that playmate. And they got Major Taylor a bicycle, and Major Taylor said, "I felt like a millionaire's son." He had no idea what prejudice was as a very young boy. He was treated very well and had everything he wanted. He started working in bike shops in Indianapolis, and he caught the eye of the owner of a bicycle manufacturing company. This person's name was Bertie Munger, and Bertie Munger soon realized that this young person had the makings of a champion. Munger had been himself the national champion in cycling years earlier in the era of the high-wheeled bicycle. So he takes Major Taylor under his wing, appropriately for a man named Bertie, and starts to train him, teaches him what he knows about championship riding. One day, Major Taylor, to improve himself, went to the YMCA, and they wouldn't let him in the door. And he said, "Why?" And they said, "Because your skin is black." And at that point, he said this was the first time that he ever faced what he called the monster prejudice. And he learned, unfortunately, more and more what that monster was like. Eventually, Bertie Munger was so taken with this young man that he moved his manufacturing company to Massachusetts and took Taylor with him and trained him to be a champion rider. And that's how, in 1896, they both ended up at Madison Square Garden, the greatest arena in the country at the time, and Major Taylor was entered in the greatest race of the time, the six-day race, in which, as it sounds, you go around the track for 6 days, a break of an hour here or there, and whoever can survive the longest wins the race. It was an inhumane contest, and it was extraordinary for this 18-year-old, that's what he was at the time, to be entered into this contest. So it was against white riders. All of them were white from around the country, around the world, the best racers from anywhere. And this young African-American from Indianapolis, who'd never been in a professional race, he just won a lot of amateur races. So it sort of sets the stage for the extraordinary career to come that he had.
And you start your book with a lovely description of that race, and maybe if we have time later, you could read part of it. And also you included a letter written by Major Taylor when he was 15, addressed to other riders, a pretty powerful letter that's in the book also. So what did Major Taylor accomplish as a cyclist? What were his records, achievements, victories?
Well, just for perspective, at the time, mid-1890s, this country had about 300 cars. They were basically experiments. They didn't have brakes. They didn't go backwards. They were considered loud, noisy contraptions that would basically not catch the fancy of the general public. Horse and buggy was a nuisance. It created this incredible, noxious piles of crap everywhere. Excuse the word, but that's what they called it. Bicycling came along, and the era of the high wheel was replaced by the era of what they called safety bicycles, what we know as today's bicycles with two equal-sized wheels, and suddenly the bicycle became a craze. Anyone could ride them. They were clean, they were sleek, they were relatively inexpensive, and I mentioned there were 300 automobiles. Pretty soon there were about 5 million bikes. So this craze swept the country. And bicycle racing became the most popular sport in the country for this brief time, more so than baseball, more so than boxing. So into this world of the bicycle craze, and where the bicycle really dominates everything in transportation, aside from, of course, trains and things like that, Major Taylor enters the racing scene. And I mentioned the six-day race. Well, before that, in the same arena, there was a preliminary match of a half mile. sprint against the best racers in the world. Incredibly, Major Taylor wins that race. Then he enters a six-day race. He manages to stay in all 6 days. A lot of riders would drop out. And so he goes 1,700 miles and comes in eighth place. That's quite a victory unto itself. And it becomes an international sensation. The race is covered by press from around the world. And after that, he becomes national champion. Then he's courted by promoters from around the world. He goes to Paris, 1901. He becomes the world champion. He goes to Australia for two seasons, becomes the champion there. He becomes one of the most famous athletes in the world, and that's what I write about in great detail in the book. How did this happen? How, at an era of Jim Crow restrictions, when basically racism was institutionalized, how did he overcome those barriers? And for perspective, this is before Jack Johnson became the world heavyweight boxing champion in 1908. It's before Jesse Owens was the champion sprinter in the 1930s and competed in Germany. It was before Jackie Robinson, a half century before Jackie Robinson, broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball. Major Taylor paved the way. He was the first, as the subtitle of the book says, America's first black sports hero. His story is somewhat forgotten. I wanted to revive that. It seemed to me that not only was he the first champion like this, but that he did much more than win races for his own glory. He really wanted to show that the racist eugenics theories of the time were wrong. And the way to disprove those was to become a champion, was to win as many races as he could. And that's what he did. So he did so much more than win a lot of races and become a champion. He managed to disprove, you know, the worst racist theories of the day. And what he wanted to be remembered for was not that he won this race or that race, but that if you're given a fair shake, if you persevere amidst the worst adversity, and you remain strong, and you keep yourself in great condition, and everything else that's required, that you can succeed in any field of human endeavor in which you attempt to aspire to become the leader in. That's what he wanted to be remembered for. If he could do that, and this was a man who was 5'7", maybe 150 pounds, not built to be a bicycle sprinter. If you know anything about sprinting, typically they're large men. They are not, you know, his build was more for someone who might be, you know, king of the mountains in the Tour de France or something, which he didn't do. So he managed to overcome that by being the most fit person imaginable. And in the book, there are photos of him when he's a scrawny 15-year-old and when he's incredibly muscular and fit.
You are listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon. We're speaking with Michael Cranish, journalist and author, whose new book, The World's Fastest Man, is an very inspiring biography of African-American cycling champion Major Taylor. And your book also includes his regimen, his diet, mm-hmm. his exercise. It's interesting reading it at, you know, in this age of nutrition, consideration about nutrition, exercise, and so forth. He encountered, you know, you mentioned the racism of the time. President Cleveland was in office, supporter of Jim Crow laws. How did bicycle organizations relate to him? What was their attitude, like the League of American Wheelmen?
Well, unfortunately, the League of American Wheelmen, which was this huge, very powerful organization. I mean, it sounds like a group of cyclists and so forth, but at the time, this was the most powerful organization you can imagine. They were behind the effort to basically pave many thousands of miles of roads in this country. They had powerful lobbying mechanisms in Washington. So they were extremely powerful. They sanctioned races. And unfortunately, what happened was they banned African Americans. It's a very sad legacy of the organization. It's called the League of American Wheelmen at the time. Today it's known as the League of American Bicyclists. Many years later, they apologized for that. Nonetheless, despite their ban of African Americans, they did grant, for various reasons, Major Taylor a racing license. So he was able to race. But eventually, there were a lot of disputes with the league. I get into that a little bit in the book. And long story short, he found that he really couldn't race with them. They fined him. Things like that happened. And so there were some promoters who realized there was an opportunity in promoting the idea of black versus white in races, that crowds would come out to see a black person race against whites. So there was one promoter in particular I write about, William Brady, who basically created a new league, you know, with the idea that he could bring Major Taylor as the star of that league. So that's what he did. He brought in some other people, and they basically created their own league so that Major Taylor could be a major competitor in that league. But he is just an example of the incredible racism that Taylor had to overcome.
And many years later, of course, they erased the restriction of you know, African Americans from their bylaws, and I think they also acknowledged their mistake in connection with Major Taylor. You mentioned meeting and interviewing Taylor's daughter, Sydney, when she was 96. Tell us a little bit about her and also about your meeting with her.
Sure. Well, Sydney was born in the city of Sydney, Australia. That's why she has her name. Major Taylor had gone there to race two seasons, 03, 04, basically. And you know, this was an extraordinary journey. When he went to Australia, how many Americans, let alone African Americans, had sailed from San Francisco to Sydney? Not that many at that time. It was a very long, difficult journey. And he was concerned when he got to the docks and someone told him there was a color line drawn in Australia, that he'd get there and they told him you're not allowed and you have to turn back. So, but when he got there, he was very gratified to see that there was an armada of ships to welcome him. So that was a great moment for Taylor. Anyway, they were welcomed. They loved the people of Australia. And Taylor and his wife, Daisy, they had their child, Sydney, born there. So when I saw Sydney many years later, she was only a young girl when she did see her father race, but she recalled seeing, as a very young girl, her father race in Paris and cheering for him. And she had been the person, basically, the only child that he had, kept all of his scrapbooks, his letters, his anything, yeah, postcards, journals, you name it. So luckily for me as a biographer, all those things were saved, and Daisy gave them to the Indiana State Museum. So I was able to go to that museum and see all the personal effects of Major Taylor, all the great scrapbooks, a lot of great material that I was able to go through to write this.
And Major Taylor also wrote a biography in the 1920s, and he's how valuable to you as a researcher was that autobiography?
Well, it certainly was very valuable. It's a lot of the autobiography is a lot of clippings that are pasted into it. It's a little tough going to get through. It's not written in a, you know, narrative style, if you will. But for a researcher like me writing a book, it's extremely valuable because there's nuggets throughout that I was able to go look for. So he might mention something that if he didn't have the background of research that I needed to write this book, you might pass over it. But he'd mention something in passing. I had read so many hundreds or thousands of articles about him that I knew exactly what he was talking about. So it was very helpful to me to read that in conjunction with reading the many clippings and other things that I read for the research of the book and had it all make sense. If you go into it cold, a lot of things you may not know exactly what he's talking about, or sometimes there's the timing is mixed up. But overall, for me, it was extremely valuable and helpful.
And you mentioned his ability to overcome some racism and, you know, and compete and win. I'm still wondering what accounts for his success, you know, for his strength of character.
Right. There are a number of things that he did. First of all, he had the best possible trainers that he could have. Bertie Munger, who'd been a world champion himself. He made bicycles, and he provided Taylor with a state-of-the-art bicycle, the best bicycle you could make, just for Taylor. So he also had, later, cycling companies brought him on as a sponsor. It was very unusual to have an African-American be the face of a major American company. He was an exception. So his face was on the promotional material. If you look at the magazines of the day, you know, they would proudly say, Major Taylor, you know, backs this bicycle. It's really something. There's just very little like that in sort of the mainstream press of the time. Yes, in African-American newspapers. I'm talking about publications aimed at everybody, you know, mostly to whites, actually. So, you know, he got a lot of great support in that way. But really what it came down to was his strength of character, as you alluded to. He was an incredibly disciplined, dedicated person. In the back of the book, as you mentioned, I included an appendix of his training methods because they're so incredibly striking. He was way ahead of his time. And he was not built for this, as I mentioned, sort of a scrawny kid. He believed that if he was an ounce over or under his weight, perfect weight, that he would lose his competitive edge. So he learned how to basically build his body through nutrition. A lot of people at the time were eating fatty foods. They drank a lot of beer. They didn't really exercise properly. None of that was true for Taylor. He did a regimen that we would recognize today as excellent. He focused on a lot of protein. He devoured massive quantities of eggs. It was one of the best ways he had to get protein. He had very little body fat. He was very muscular. He had a training routine that involved jumping rope, using a pulley system, using a boxing thing that you pound your fists against, a punching ball or whatever it's called from the ceiling, and a lot of other methods. I mean, if you go back and look, and I describe a lot of these because I just thought this is remarkable how he did this. He also said abstain from alcohol, abstain from tobacco. Everything had to be perfect. There was more than simply nutrition behind this. At the time, there were these racist eugenics theories that said that blacks were inherently inferior, that there was that's the way they were built, supposedly. When that came out, there was a government study of individuals to determine actually what made them the type of person they were. And to do this study, incredibly, as I found in this research, they studied bicycling champions. They studied Major Taylor's contemporaries to do this study. And what they determined was that how you develop is not some inherent deficiency. It's how you're raised. It's what you eat. It's how you train. It's many, many different things like that. All that put together determines the type of individual you are and the type of athlete that you could be. So Taylor knew this. He was aware of this, and he built himself from the best studies that were available at the time to make himself into really one of the fittest people on the planet.
And you devoted 18 years to research and writing. I'm wondering...
Well, off and on. I did not spend 18 years writing.
You wrote also about Mitt Romney,
four
John
other
Kerry.
Books and a lot of other daily stories, yes.
Okay.
But off and on, yes.
So and we have about 4 or 5 more minutes. The time just flew by like one of Major Taylor races. I'm wondering how the book changed you. What did you learn about yourself? And maybe if it's not too big a subject, what could Major Taylor's story tell us about ourselves as individuals in a nation in 2019? A struggle for dignity, maybe race relations?
I mean, that's really why I wrote the book. I didn't write the book to just write about an obscure racing person. I wrote it because I really wanted to explore the history of our country. I'm constantly trying to understand how we got to where we are today. That's true if I write about Jefferson, if I write about Trump, you name it. It's really a larger quest to understand who we are as a people, how did we get here, what's divided us. So I looked at this and I just was really interested in this period of time when the Jim Crow era intersected with the Gilded Age. And you had these contrasting eras against each other. And very specifically, the 1896 case of Plessy versus Ferguson that basically institutionalized racism in this country with Jim Crow restrictions and laws, that was decided in 1896, and it was only 7 months later that Major Taylor emerges and races in the race in Madison Square Garden that I mentioned. So he's right there basically disproving, the rationale for that heinous, 7-1 Supreme Court decision. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to understand that. And when you write a book of history, in my eyes, I want to write it. It's a very exciting time, a very terrible time. And I wanted to capture that. And here's a man really unparalleled in our history. And I wanted to see it through his eyes. I knew his story, and I thought, I can write a book of history and weave into it throughout it, every chapter, his story, the way he saw it, because he ended up being one of the most chronicled African-American individuals of his time. So I just thought, what a unique way to try to understand a very crucial era that, even to this day, has a lot of resonance.
And in the last few years, there's greater recognition of Major Taylor. In his in Worcester, Massachusetts, there's a statue, a street named for him. The school, local school, includes a curriculum unit about him. And hopefully in the next few years, we'll see greater recognition, which your book, of course, helps. Maybe he'll even be on a stamp, like Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and John Lennon.
That's a great idea. I mean, one of the things that's happening, I've given talks around the country, and there are Major Taylor cycling clubs. And I know there are clubs all over the place because I've met a lot of the individuals from those clubs. When I was in Chicago, I had the opportunity to go see the Major Taylor Trail. And on this trail is a wonderful quote, and it says, a quote from Major Taylor where he says, I was a pioneer, and so I had to blaze my own trail. So double meaning there. Mm-hmm. And I just hope that, other cities will follow that example. So maybe in Portland, somebody will take a trail, and you have so many wonderful ones there, and call it the Major Taylor Trail. Maybe that's something that will be spread around the country and will help, his name become even more known. And I certainly hope doing this book, adds to that as well. He certainly deserves to be in the pantheon of the greatest athletes in the history of this country and civil rights figures as well.
And this is a good place to end. Thank you, Michael Cranish, for your wonderful book, The World's Fastest Man, which is available at your local bookstore. And I wish you all the best with your future writing and with your life. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Ride safe.
And you are listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon at 90.7 FM and streaming live at kbo.fm. Our guest in the first half of the show was journalist and author Michael Cranish, whose excellent new book, The World's Fastest Man, tells the story of African-American cycling champion Major Taylor and his era. In the second half of our show, we will be joined by historian Evan Friss, who will talk about 200 years of cycling in New York City, the subject of his new book. We'll be back in a minute after a few station announcements.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 11:30. Right now you're listening to The Bike Show, but coming up at the noon hour is jazz. And don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. And all of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, you can just go to our website at KBOO.fm or use our mobile app and click on that red donate button.
Broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon. Our guest in the second half of the show is historian Evan Friss. Professor Friss has studied and written about the intersections between American history and culture and the bicycle. His first book was The Cycling City, Bicycles in Urban America in the 1890s. His just released book on bicycles, A 200-Year History of Cycling in New York City, published by Columbia University Press, is a wonderful account of the people, groups, and forces that shaped the metropolis's complex relationship with the vehicle and shows how the bicycle shaped the city and its citizens as well. Good day, Evan, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And where does this find you today? In New York City or...
I'm in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Ah, okay.
Where I now call home.
Ah. Before we get to New York City and bicycles over there, just a quick question about yourself, maybe some of your early bicycle memories, your background.
Sure. I grew up in, I was born in New York City, but spent most of my formative years in Columbia, Maryland, which was a new kind of suburb built and planned in the late 1960s that was supposed to be a kind of anti-suburb in many ways. But one of the ways in which it sought to be a different kind of suburb was through affording a great deal of green space and also to de-emphasize motor vehicle transit. So I grew up in a neighborhood that was lined with bicycle paths that my friends and I used to wander on, both on foot and on bike, and spend a lot of time sort of riding through the paths and perhaps thinking about mobility in that way. But I wasn't, you know, a serious cyclist, just a kind of recreational rider. And then when I got to graduate school, I was interested in studying the history of American cities, city planning, urban design, and was particularly interested in thinking about
how it is we make the choices that we do about getting from A to B, and the consequences of those decisions and the constraints of those decisions. And so the bicycle became a way to ask those questions, and the bicycle became a tool for me in New York anyway, of getting around.
And you start in 1819, when the first bicycles were created, actually, by Baron Vaudreuil, at least the dandy horse, as it's known. Who were those first cyclists in New York?
So there weren't very many, probably, but they were mostly entrepreneurs, people looking to take advantage of the latest fad, or some people who were smitten by these whimsical devices, people who had money, some leisure time, interest in hobbies. And interestingly enough, these devices, that bicycles are kind of antecedents to bicycles because they didn't have pedals, they only lasted a few months in New York before the local lawmakers banned them from most of the places they were being ridden. And they don't explain why they banned them, but most likely it was because they were seen as out of control devices driven by reckless riders who were imperiling people in lower Manhattan. And so the very beginning, the origin story of the bicycle in America, is one about both excitement and opportunity, what will this new contraption afford, but also one of restriction, in that within just a few months they are in fact banned.
And this interplay between objection and enthusiasm, bans and praise, seems to run throughout your book, you know, at different eras, at different times. It seems like already in the 1860s there were citizens who saw the bicycle as a solution to some of the city's ills. What were they saying about the bicycle then?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The bicycle, for many advocates and cheerleaders, including the people who manufactured them, of course, but also riders and enthusiasts, saw in the bicycle a kind of antidote to many of the urban ills. So although their sense of, you know, the environment is different than ours is today, and they didn't necessarily have the same kind of scientific knowledge, they still understood basic tenets of environmental damage and decay. They certainly understood that pollution was toxic, and they believed, especially many health advocates and doctors at the time, that you needed exercise, that you needed access to the outdoors, that you needed access to clean air, that streetcars and horses were polluting the urban environment. And so the bicycle seemed to be a tonic, in one way by providing exercise, but also allowing city residents a way to escape the toxic city. And so for the same reason that they built Central Park and other big parks in the middle of the 19th century as this kind of urban oasis to escape the clamor and unhealthy aspects of urban life, the bicycle could literally take you to a beach, a countryside, a mountaintop, where the air is fresh and where you can also reap mental health benefits, some quiet, some relaxation, some you know, healing, taking the kind of healing benefits of nature.
And one of the things you do well is remind us that New York was not always, you know, what is it now, about a quarter of the city is paved road or something like that, but that actually there were a lot of greenery. Brooklyn was kind of rural, and that's a nice reminder of how cities develop and change. It seems like the late 19th century, which was also the subject of your first book, was one of those periods where there was really a bicycle craze. How did it manifest in New York City at the time?
So New York was probably more bicycle crazy than any place on the earth in the 1890s. And we often think of people who are most invested in bicycling as being people from other countries, whether they be kind of modern day European countries or other Asian countries in which people depend on the bicycle greatly. But in the 1890s, Americans become smitten with bicycles, and nowhere more so than in New York, where hundreds of thousands of people adopt the bicycle as a means of recreation and also as a means of transportation and to be engaged in middle-class leisure. In the 1890s, to take your bike out for a spin on Riverside Drive or through Central Park, there were people who commuted to work. Lots of clubs mushroomed throughout the city. In fact, there were several hundred bicycle clubs in New York at the time, about the same.
And women cyclists were also numerous in New York City?
Yes, although they were always outnumbered by men. I estimate there was about 20 or 25% of the population was female, which actually isn't all that different from what it is today. And some of these women started their own clubs. There were a few bike clubs that were mixed, but many New Yorkers, women and men, saw this as a kind of emancipatory device that could afford women the opportunity to travel to different spaces in the city and to engage with the city in a different way, to be on a device that was seen as a very masculine device, to exercise, and there was great hope that the bicycle would unlock new social, political, cultural opportunities.
And during that era, along with the great enthusiasm, it seems like there were also battles about bicycle use, opposition to a plan, the Coney Island Cycle Plan of 1890. It's interesting to see how things change and then many things remain the same, as the cliche goes. Your book, you do a very good job, I think, in the book, focusing on the movement, the population, but also certain interesting individuals. And among those that are very, loom large is Robert Moses. Tell us a little bit about him and what his attitude to bicycles was.
Robert Moses is famous for being the Parks Commissioner of New York and chairman of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority and lots of other things, but he essentially was, the greatest builder that New York has ever seen, and oversaw the construction of bridges and tunnels and highways and parks and playgrounds and swimming pools for much of the 20th century in New York City. And he is rightly known as the champion, the great champion of the automobile. And you can look around the modern landscape today and point your finger, and you're likely to find something that Moses built. And many New Yorkers will often lament what he built, because he, of course, was working in the age of the motor car, and he lauds the automobile and often designs around that. But in researching the book, I uncovered this interesting episode in the 1930s in which he goes all in on bicycles and promotes a plan to lay nearly 59 miles of bicycle paths across the five boroughs of New York City. And at the time, very few cities were building any infrastructure for cyclists. This was a period in which, after the 1890s bike boom dies down, there's another uptick of interest in the bicycle, but it's really small compared to the 1890s. And most city planners and politicians aren't taking it very seriously. But Moses pushes this very bold scheme to lay bicycle paths within parks and alongside his parkways. At the same time, it's also clear that he's invested in trumpeting the automobile, and that he realizes that as bicycles are becoming more popular, wants to preserve the road space for motor car and doesn't want cyclists to be obstacles on the street. So part of it is about privileging automobiles, but a lot of the cyclists were happy with the idea of, nearly 60 miles of bike path all to their own.
You're listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studios in Portland, Oregon. We're speaking with historian Evan Friss about his new book, on bicycles, a 200-year history of cycling in New York City. What were some of the historical records and sources you used, and what was the most surprising things you discovered during your research?
I used a range of sources, including legal and political documents, so documents, legal briefs that came around bike bans, both from the 1819 iteration and also in later in the 19th century, bicyclists are banned from Central Park, and there's some great depositions that are recorded about cyclists wanting to gain access to the park, and they talk a great deal about what it's like to be a cyclist at the time. Other kinds of municipal records, so, you know, we just were talking about Robert Moses. He, of course, has lots of letters and papers that are archived in the municipal archives in New York, which were great. And then there are some great personal archival pieces that really helped knit the story together. So one example is a cyclist in the 1890s. His name is Arthur Hyde. He's not famous. There's no reason for anybody to know him. He's no Major Taylor, as your first guest was talking about. He's a kind of just regular New York City cyclist, but he leaves this very comprehensive cycling diary in which he records and narrates about every single bike trip he takes over the course of 3 years in the 1890s, thousands of miles ridden. And he notes down the road conditions, the weather, his traveling partners, his destination, what he sees, and it really gives great color to the cycling scene of the 1890s that other sources often.
And this, cannot. Did you find this source in one of the archives or libraries? Or?
Yeah, this is actually in the New York Historical Society Library. Hmm. And as far as I can tell, nobody's ever looked at it before, which is also fun and interesting.
Is there something specific about New York City itself that affects the relationship with bicycles? Is it the fact that it's a finance capital of the United States, the lay of the land, ethnic and religious composition? I mean, is it? Did you feel like the relations, the events you describe are unique to New York, or we could find them in Chicago, let's say?
To a certain degree, New York has its own story, and part of it is it's related to congestion and density. So some of the advantages of a bicycle, especially that people saw in the 19th century, but even today in terms of being a viable alternative to an automobile, are even greater in New York than many other cities, because in New York, most people commute to work is less than 3 miles, and that's not common in many other places, that kind of thing. But also, as you mentioned or alluded to, the issue of finance, bike messengers exist in most other cities throughout, or at least in the latter parts of the 20th century. But in the 1980s, there are more bike messengers in New York City than anywhere else, in large part because there are more bankers and lawyers and modeling agencies and all the rest that require them. So that develops this really large messenger community who then become maligned, which leads to a great clash between the mayor at the time, Ed Koch, who tries to ban bike messengers, and the messengers themselves. So there's animosity between messengers and citizens and politicians in most American cities, but the stakes are often higher in New York. But I do think, you know, there are interesting stories to tell for other cities, and they would have some parallels to New York, but also some differences. And where you are in Portland, I think would be a great subject and site and setting for some to think about the bicycle history of that city.
Is that perhaps the subject of your next book?
I'm afraid not, but I would look forward to reading that book.
And mentioning the bike messengers, you know, battle they had with the mayor and the city, which I followed at the time, so I was glad to see you write about it, and that famous photograph of one of the messengers, Steve the Greek, Athenius, hoisting his bicycle above his head while he's dressed in a very skimpy outfit. That was a nice reminder. I'm wondering, as a historian, you know, what did you learn about the way change happens? Is it the work of individuals, movements? What do you think the history of cycling in New York City could tell us about political change in this country?
I think there's a lot to learn. And you just mentioned Steve, the Greek Athenios, who's the de facto leader of the messengers in the 1980s, and he leads the charge on the streets and these daily protests against Koch's bike ban, and becomes one of the a handful of people who sue the city and ultimately win. And so the bike ban is tabled, and it's pitched from above, from Mayor Koch, and supported by many people in City Hall. And here are the bike messengers, who are largely underpaid, many of whom are African-American or Latino, and they manage to win, and they do so with personality. They do so with pluck and courage and demonstrations. And there's a lot of stories throughout the history of bike advocacy working. And in the periods in which cycling falls out of favor, and in which the kind of cycling arms and organizations like the League of American Wheelmen, or in New York City, Transportation Alternatives, when those organizations are less muscular, you know, less change happens. And I think there's a pretty clear link between people knocking on the doors of City Hall and demanding things and things happening. Now, that's not to say, of course, that the history of cycling is one in which the cyclists get what they want. It's largely not. But I think there are a lot of stories of individuals advocating for change. And it's not the kind of issue that often comes from above. It's not something that mayors of New York come into office usually as part of their agenda. So I think that's important for people to keep
and
in mind.
You also showed the importance, Jane Jacobs, for example, you know, her, even though she didn't focus on bicycles, but her views, her values seem to influence a lot of people. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Sure. She, of course, is famous for being a thorn in Robert Moses's side for saving Washington Square Park from his planned expressway that would have cut through the heart of the park and much of Greenwich Village. And she's an intellectual who writes several books about, you know, the ways in which cities should be designed and the ways in which cities can be great and why some of them have faced decline. And she's writing in this era in which people are moving out of cities, in which they're being seen as increasingly dangerous and unlivable. So much of what she advocates has to do with the streets themselves and sidewalks and design. But it's really about making cities scale to the person, to the individual human, having activity on the street, having short blocks where people will walk up and down many different roads and interact with many different kinds of people, in which the streets will be used at different times of the day for different purposes. And she doesn't explicitly write a lot about bicycles, but it's clear that it's clear to me at least, that her perspective is shaped by being a cyclist herself. And she is living in New York City in the middle of the 20th century, at a time when very few New Yorkers are riding bicycles, let alone women. And she is a regular commuter. She goes from her West Village apartment to Midtown Manhattan, where she's a writer, and she bikes all the way, despite the fact that people are yelling at her, criticizing her, teasing her for riding a bike. And then she parks her bicycle in a garage full of Cadillacs, as she describes that in some article that she wrote. And in the book, I have this image of her, which is, I think, the best image I've ever seen of her. partly, of course, because of my own interest in the subject matter, but she's on a bicycle in New York City taking a posed photograph in front of a gas station. And, you know, I don't know what she's sort of saying or what the funny caption should be, but there's lots of possibilities. She's kind of, you know, she's being provocative without actually saying anything. So, yeah, I think it's the way, you know, she sees the city from the pace of a cyclist, the perspective of a cyclist, this kind of human scale that might be very different from Robert Moses, who is famously driven around in the backseat of a car, right, and sees New York in that way.
And we have a few more minutes, so I'd like to ask you about cycling in New York City today. Is it a good place to cycle? Do a lot of people use bike sharing? And also, if your crystal ball is not too cloudy, how do you see cycling? What do you imagine cycling in New York City to be like in 10 years, 50 years? That's assuming, of course, that the rising seas will not flood it. So,
right. In New York today, there are many more accommodations for cyclists, probably than there have ever been in the 200 years in which bicycles have existed in New York. And a lot of this is owed to Jeanette Sadi-Khan, the previous transportation commissioner during the Bloomberg administration, who oversaw miles and miles of protected bike lanes being built and who launched CityBike, which is by far the nation's most popular bike share program. And both of those things, I think, very clearly work and have encouraged not just more New Yorkers to ride, but more New York to think about the bicycle as a utilitarian device, as an alternative to the car, as a real legitimate way to move around, to commute. And that's an amazing, powerful transformation. In the last few years, I think there's been fewer creative solutions. And I think the number of cyclists isn't increasing at the same rate as it once was. And very recently, as in since this calendar year, the number of cyclists who've been killed has increased dramatically. So I think there's been this great increase in terms of both cyclist safety and the number of cyclists from, you know, the early 2000s to the end of the Bloomberg era, but because this administration, the de Blasio administration, has been less bold and less encouraging of the bicycle, a lot of those gains have either moderated or been disappeared, and disappeared. And sadly, you know, there have been some really terrible incidents involving cyclists lately. And as far as the future, I think the 200 years of history shows that a lot of the reasons that Americans ride bicycles has to do with culture and has to do with social reasons, what's fashionable. And it's clear that bicycles have become chic again in the 21st century, and I think it's only reasonable to assume that they will to some degree fall out of fashion. The trick is to sort of make sure you can get enough built and encourage enough cyclists to become cyclists in the peak years, because of course infrastructure lasts a long time. So cyclists have had to become cyclists in New York and elsewhere in cities that were designed not for them. So I don't know what the future holds, but in order to encourage cycling in the future, the more we can build now, the better.
Okay, and this is a good place to end. Thank you so much, Professor Evan Frist, for joining us today. It was a pleasure to have you on our show, and all the best with your future scholarship and life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, have a good day. You've been listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon, on the first Wednesday of every month. We'll have links to all our guests' websites and their books on our Facebook page. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all the past episodes are archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The Bike Show is produced by Tori Bortman, April Streeter, and Alon Robb. We'd like to thank our engineer today, Ty Walker, our web host, Chris Smith, and today's guests. Comments, questions, show ideas are always welcome, and you can contact us on Facebook at our Twitter handle, which is at KBO Bike Show, or email us through the KBO website, and handwritten letters are also welcome. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the vast bike world. Until then, have safe, joyous, and enlightening rides. Everybody, get on your bicycle.
Let's get together. The time is 11:59. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Next up, we have Jazz Lives.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Wednesday, July 3rd, 2019. In local news, members of the Portland Pride Boys Rally, an alt-right neo-fascist organization, and left-wing counter-protesters clashed over the weekend. Though the most surprising result of the event was the Portland Police Bureau's unsubstantiated claim that the counter-protesters were throwing milkshakes containing quick-drying cement during the rally. However, the milkshakes were concrete-free and, better yet, vegan. Throwing milkshakes has become a leftist protest method aimed at embarrassing the far right. In national news, the founders of the Straight Pride Parade, set to take place in Boston this August, say that they have been sent, quote, suspicious packages containing glitter and letters. The organizers from Super Happy Fun America have called the incidents, quote, the acts of domestic terrorists. Police have reported the packages contain no explosives or dangerous substances. Organizers say that the Straight Pride Parade is celebrating the, quote, diverse history, culture, and contribution.